This is BPN Radio, your 24-hour internet prayer station, calling America to pray. It's time now for the Christian War Room with your host, Michael Schonborn. Now, here's Michael.
You're listening to the Christian War Room, and for the last couple of, is it probably about a month or something, we've been looking a lot at the theory of evolution and the problems we've got with it. And as I mentioned before, and I'm maybe repeating myself again and again, but one of the key points is that the theory of evolution simply doesn't work. The theory of evolution just doesn't work. There are so many flaws with it. Obviously, the truth is the truth. It's either going to be one or the other. And whatever evidence we find is going to align itself very much so with the truth. And we've got this problem with the theory of evolution that so many things are just simply not tying up. And more academics, you know, who dare to ask questions come to similar conclusions. So what we have here is we've got a professor by the name of Jonathan Wells. And he has got a PhD in molecular and cell biology, and he works for the University of California, Berkeley. So, I mean, this guy is not somebody you could ignore. For example, like myself, I'm an engineer. I maybe know a little bit about electronics and how to implement this, and I know a little bit about systems and engineering, but I'm certainly not a specialist in evolution and evolutionary science or whatever you want to call it. But I do have common sense. I do have an understanding of academia and the world of academia, having had to do my little bit as well. And I can also see the downfall of the world of academia, and not necessarily everything produced by scientists is a reflection of the ultimate and undeniable truth. And this is one of the things we have to bear in mind. Now, as far as theory of evolution goes, it's a huge, huge problem theologically. You accept the theory of evolution. In that case, I would suggest you give up your faith in Jesus Christ, because everything is based on what happened in Genesis. And that is a key point. Sin came into the world through the disobedience of one man. And the New Testament picks up on it again and again. And we needed God to become flesh, to die on our behalf instead of us, to atone for the sin, for the wrath of God to be gratified. And I think that is sort of a core message of Christianity. And when you take a Genesis away, you end up with a big problem. Then the other thing, obviously, is what is the truth? You know, is it creationism? Is it the story of Adam and Eve, or is it the theory of evolution? And when we look at the evidence around us, and this is the other just blatant thing, when we look at the evidence around us, pretty much once you sort of analyze the evidence, and when you see and you try to understand what the evolutionists try and make us believe, some of the assumptions they make in their quest of trying to justify the process of evolution. Once you see behind all this, you can see straight away that it is a house of cards. And all you need is just push over one of the cards and the whole house is going to come down in one big smash. And that's pretty much what it is. A lot of it was based and built on ideas and concepts they had in the 1800s, not understanding a great deal of knowledge which only became available sort of in the early to mid 1900s. So once we had an understanding of that, once we had the technology to sort of get a deeper understanding of what's going on in life itself, in human life, in cell biology, a lot of the ideas which were formulated in the early days of, the theory of evolution in the 1800s, early 1800s to mid 1800s, they just wouldn't hold up anymore. But people still clung to them because that's what's being taught somewhere between 50 and 100 years. And so people just picked up these concepts, built up on them, and we ended up with the theory of evolution. Okay, let's start and play in the talk there from Professor Jonathan Wealth from California Berkeley University. And he's got a PhD in molecular science. As I mentioned it before, I'm just looking for the mouse, and here we go.
I wrote about 10 icons of evolution in my book. I could have written about more, but I had to stop somewhere. And the 10 that I wrote about were, first of all, the 1950 Miller-Urey experiment that purported to show that life could have begun spontaneously on the early Earth. And this is still found in most biology textbooks, even though geochemists decades ago decided that the experiment was unrealistic and really doesn't say anything substantial about the origin of life. The second icon was Darwin's Tree of Life, the branching pattern that would show how all organisms descended from a common ancestor at the root. And this is a theoretical statement, but it's presented in most biology textbooks as though it were a fact. The fossil evidence, for example, does not show this branching tree pattern. When you look at the different major groups of animals, they appear pretty much at the same time, rather than diverging from a common ancestor. The third icon I wrote about was homology in vertebrate limbs. If you look at the bone structure of the human hand or the human arm, you compare that to a whale's flipper or a bird's wing or a bat's wing, there are certain striking similarities in the bone structure. And Darwin considered this to be a result of common descent. But people before Darwin had noticed the same thing, and they called it, they attributed it to a common designer. Well, the truth is, it could be either one. The bone structure itself doesn't tell us. The fourth icon is Haeckel's embryo drawings, which purport to show that vertebrates are very similar as early embryos, and therefore this provides evidence for common ancestry. But in fact, the embryos are not similar, and Haeckel faked the drawings. The fifth icon that I wrote about was Archaeopteryx, a famous fossil of an ancient bird that had a long tail and teeth in its beak like reptiles, and for a long time was thought to be the missing link between reptiles and birds. Biologists no longer think that because there are too many differences between Archaeopteryx and modern birds, but textbooks tend to present it as the missing link anyway. The peppered moth is a famous icon of evolution in which moths supposedly changed color during the Industrial Revolution because dark moths were better camouflaged on soot darkened tree trunks, and the birds couldn't see them, and so they ate the light moths and left the dark ones. And this is still used in many textbooks as a classic example of natural selection in action, when in fact biologists discovered in the 1980s that peppered moths don't rest on tree trunks in the wild at all, or normally. And so the textbook pictures have all been staged, and the story has serious flaws. Darwin's finches, another icon of evolution, are some species of birds on the Galapagos Islands that are very similar except for the size and shape of their beaks. And it's thought, and it's quite possible, that they evolved from a common ancestor because of having to eat different foods on the different islands. But the actual evidence shows us only that the beaks can change over a matter of years based on climate and diet. But the changes are temporary, they oscillate back and forth, and they don't go anywhere. So as evidence for the origin of species, Darwin's finches really don't work. Another icon of evolution is the four-winged fruit fly. Most fruit flies have two wings, but a series of mutations in a fruit fly can cause it to develop a second set of wings, very normal looking, but in fact there are no muscles attached to it, so the second set of wings is effectively dead. The fly is a hopeless cripple. It's kind of like having a small plane with an extra pair of wings tied to its tail. This is not the forerunner of a new race of insects, but an evolutionary dead end. The last two icons I wrote about were fossil horses and the ape-to-human picture. In both cases, there is some real evidence here. The important point in both of these icons, I'll mention them together, is that A very heavy dose of philosophy is laid onto the evidence in each case, mainly to persuade students that evolution is without direction or purpose. In the case of the ape to human icon, students are also told that humans, in effect, are nothing more than animals. Neither one of those claims comes from the evidence. Both of those are philosophical claims, but they use the evidence to make themselves appear more scientific than they really are. And so that's my criticism of those two icons.
I have to assume that. We have no reason not to think that. In the Cambrian, we can see animals that are just like modern arthropods in their body plan, just like modern vertebrates, just like modern mollusks, various kinds of worms, echinoderms, which include the starfish. When we watch them develop today, we have no reason to think that similar animals in the Cambrian didn't develop the same way. And that's why the Cambrian fossils are recognizable in most cases as members of modern animal phyla. So the complexity is already there, full-blown, right from the start. And if the complexity is there, then the complexity of development is also there, because presumably these animals all developed from a single fertilized egg. And so the processes we see now, we can, I think, legitimately extrapolate back to the Cambrian. Before the Cambrian, whatever forms of animal life we had were far simpler than what we have in the Cambrian. So the genetic materials to support the diversity of life in the Cambrian had to appear rather suddenly. It was an explosion of genetic information, very real, and I think inexplicable on Darwinian terms. But there was also an explosion of information of another sort, and that's the information that gets us body plans. The body plan, as far as we know, is not in the DNA. For example, we know a lot of genes that play roles in development that are very similar in fruit flies and humans. And yet fruit flies and humans have totally different body plans. It turns out that those genes, the most impressive ones, the most dramatic ones, are active fairly late in embryo development, long after the body plan is established. So whatever is establishing the body plan, it's something else. And there obviously had to be an explosion of body plans as well as an explosion of DNA information. Certainly DNA is essential. You cannot get an animal without the proper DNA. But developmental biologists know that there's a lot more to development than the DNA. We sometimes hear the notion of a genetic program where the DNA is the blueprint for the organism. That's quite a common image. But in fact, we know that there's a lot of information for development that's not in the DNA. So properly speaking, the DNA is not the blueprint. It's more like a parts list. The DNA provides the body, the animal body, with proteins and RNAs and other chemical constituents, but the DNA does not dictate the form of the animal, as far as we know. Well, a house is another good analogy for the way DNA functions in the cell. The DNA, as I said, is like a parts list. Well, I could create 10 different piles of building materials, all of them identical, all of them with, you know, lots of lumber and piping and wiring and nails and roofing and cement and so on. Same thing in each pile. And give each pile to a different person and send them off where they can't see each other and say, okay, build me a house. And the odds that any two of those houses would look the same are very slim. Because with the same materials, you can build all kinds of structures. And it's the same with the cell. The DNA provides the building materials or the list of building materials, but then the cell decides the floor plan. The floor plan is somewhere else, because to build a house, you just can't have building materials. You need actually assembly instructions. You have to do things in a certain order. If you build the roof first, you're in big trouble. You have to put the foundation in, you know, the walls, the piping, the wiring. You need a certain sequence here. And you need a floor plan to know how to lay out the floor and the walls to begin with, where to put the windows. And the DNA gives us the list of parts, but the rest, for the most part, certainly the floor plan is somewhere else. We've known all along that most mutations are either harmful or neutral. Neutral meaning they don't have any noticeable effect, at least not right away. But really, beneficial mutations, which would be the only kind evolution could use anyway, are extremely rare. Furthermore, they are biochemical in nature. For example, in antibiotic resistance, we know mutations can lead to antibiotic resistance, and then those bacteria can survive in the presence of, say, streptomycin, where others could not. But the bacteria that survive are still the same species of bacteria, still tuberculosis, for example. So even the rare beneficial mutations we find do not really transform the organism. They make minor changes within existing species, which have never been controversial. And, of course, the evidence for mutations has already suggested that to us. I can take a fruit fly embryo, and this has been done, in fact, and it can be mutated in every possible way, the DNA. And there are only three possible outcomes: a normal fruit fly, a defective fruit fly, or a dead fruit fly. That's it. You can't even change the species, much less get a horsefly or a horse or something like that. Well, we've certainly found a lot of evidence, but for what? Darwin's theory is that all living things are descended from a common ancestor, modified by unguided natural processes such as natural selection and variation. Darwin didn't write a book called How Existing Species Change Over Time. That's not even relevant. People have known that for centuries. So minor changes within existing species are not the issue here. And yet when Darwinists say there's overwhelming evidence for Darwin's theory, 90% of what they talk about is minor changes within existing species. That's not the point at all. The point is the origin of new species by this same process. And no one has ever observed the origin of a new species through variation and selection. And they've tried. They've tried many times. But that key element in Darwin's theory, the origin of a new species, the title of his book, has never been solved. Now, the common ancestry part, the argument for that is usually based on similarities and differences. You know, I look, you know, I have certain similarities to this animal or that animal, and certain dissimilarities which show this or that. Well, those arguments are interesting, but they're not conclusive, because you can argue the same way on the basis of common design. You know, I look like this and not like that because there's a design reason for that. You can do the same with cars. In fact, Darwinists have used car models as an illustration of descent with modification, but cars are designed. They're created by engineers. So until you get this one important step where one species can originate from another species, why should I accept common ancestry at all? Because the mechanism is not there. The similarities and differences can cut either way. But what we're totally lacking at this point is good evidence for Darwin's basic mechanism.
Yeah, that was quite amazing there from a professor from Berkeley University in California. Okay, we've got one more talk. I just want to fit into this, and this is from Kent Hovind. He talks about DNA and the complexity of DNA. Again, we always have to bear in mind, in the whole idea of the theory of evolution, origin of species, all came from the early 1800s, and very often it was just, I think it was sort of a rebellion against the establishment. There was something like the new kid around the block, the new idea, you know, everybody had to listen to, and scientists started raging about. And then we come to the 20th century, so the 1900s, and people started taking this stuff on board and very often came up with ideas which were quite fantastic. Now, again, when the theory of evolution started, the microscope... They had microscopes, but they were very rudimentary. Jena, Zeiss in Jena only sort of developed the the whole idea about lenses and being able to calculate lenses for a particular magnification, he only developed it in the mid-1800s to late 1800s. So that was actually quite late. Yeah? So they didn't have the technology in those days to really understand what was going on in life, to understand a cell, to understand what is going on inside of a cell. Today we know that the amount of genes which are inside a cell are absolutely amazing. So a very simple cell, single celler, you know, what people thought, this is where life started from. We've got over 500,000 genes. Yeah? And these genes, they contain all the information just for a single cell, just for a single cell to function, just to operate. So that means before life even started, we needed to have amino acids or, you know, gene pairs of over 500,000 in the correct sequence to do a very basic form of life. And you come to a point, you know, this is just crazy. It's just absolutely crazy. Absolutely crazy, yeah, what these people come up with. Okay, let's have a listen to Ken Hovind, and then we'll conclude this talk on the theory of evolution for today here in the Christian War Room.
They are lying to your kids. Nothing about DNA has helped with the evolution theory at all. DNA, which stands for deoxyribonucleic acid, is the most complex molecule in the universe. Unbelievably complicated molecule. That little DNA molecule, average person has 50 trillion cells in their body with 46 of those little molecules in each cell. 46 chromosome strands in each cell of your body. If you extracted all of it, it would only fill about 2 tablespoons. But if you took those DNA strands and unwound them, stretched them out, tied them together, one person's DNA would reach from Earth to the moon and back over 500,000 times, round trips to the moon. They say the DNA holds more information than all computer programs ever written by man combined. IBM models the newest computers after DNA. The quantity of information is so vast, we have to invent new numbers to measure it. Not terabytes, petabytes, or exabytes, yottabytes, and zettabytes. All the words uttered by everyone who ever lived would amount to 5 exabytes. And your DNA and your chromosome holds more information than that? It is so unbelievably complex. If you typed out the code found in your DNA, when you got done typing, you'd have enough books to fill Grand Canyon 78 times. That's the instructions to make you. I'd say you're pretty special. Quite a list of instructions to make you. David said, I will praise thee, for I'm fearfully and wonderfully made. And he didn't have a microscope, and he could figure that out. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, from conception to birth, the baby adds 15,000 cells per minute to its body. Each one is more complicated than a space shuttle. How would you like to be in charge of the supply end of supplying a factory that is producing 15,000 space shuttles a minute? And it's your job to make sure they have all the nuts and bolts and screws and everything they need to put that thing together. Some of you women are saying, boy, I did it. And that's hard, too. Sometimes they want pickles in the middle of the night, you know. What are you building down there anyway, you know? the probability of one DNA happening by chance has been calculated to be 1 in 10 to the 119,000th power. That's a big number when you figure the entire visible universe is about 10 to the 28 inches in diameter. DNA has not proven anything that would help the evolution theory. It's been made the problem much, much, much worse. But let's just assume that the chromosome number means something. And that, you know, it could evolve. Okay, well then I did some research on this. I discovered penicillin has 2 chromosomes. That one had to evolve first. And then slowly, over millions of years, they got some more chromosomes, because they're complicated, you know, and turned into a fruit fly. You can see the similarity there. It's only got 8 chromosomes. And then very slowly, it evolved some more chromosomes and became either a tomato or a house fly. Very tough to tell the difference. They're identical twins, you know. And then very slowly, over millions of years, it evolved into either a pea or a bee. You can see the similarity there, you know, pea, bee, very similar. And slowly became lettuce and then a carrot. And finally, when we got to 22 chromosomes, triplets. The possum, the redwood tree, and the kidney bean all have 22 chromosomes. Average scientists cannot tell them apart. Let's see, which one is which here? Okay, let's see. Tree, possum, bean, huh. And we have 46, folks. And if we can just get two more, the next step of human evolution, we're going to become a tobacco plant. I know some already smell like it. Sometimes I'll get on the elevator and I'll say, man, you're evolving. You're way ahead of me. And it probably won't happen in my lifetime, but we might get enough chromosomes someday to be either a dog or a chicken. They're twins too, you know. And then way down the road, you know, we're going to become a carp. They got double the chromosomes we do. And someday, star date 349572, we're going to become a fern. I was at a church one time and this lady walked up to me afterwards and she said, Mr. Hovind, I'm fern. I shook hands with that hand right there. I'll never wash it again. Hey, how come the evolutionists are always comparing things that fit their theory? Why don't they show us the things that don't fit their theory? Like, let's just say we're going to examine how things evolve based upon how long they lived. Well, we could arrange animals by how long they live, and we'll find out the hamster evolved first, slowly turned into a cat, and then a canary, and then a dog, and then a chimpanzee, and an alligator, elephant, horse, turtle, and human. We made it, folks. We made it. Let's arrange the animals based on how long they're pregnant, their gestation period. Well, in that case, the possum, only 13 days. How'd you like that, ladies? Only be pregnant for 13 days. Not bad, huh? Yeah, I'd have a bunch of kids in. Slowly evolved into a hamster, then a rat, then a rabbit, kangaroo, on down the list, and the elephant. 640 days. They are the winner. The most evolved creature on earth. Or maybe you can see here the cat and the dog are identical twins, you know. Maybe we should arrange them based on how much they weigh in their adult form. Well, the shrew only weighs 4 grams. Slowly it became a mouse. And very slowly, slowly, over billions of years, became a whale. The whale's the most evolved now. Why don't they show us these charts, huh? And why is it that amphibians have 5 times more DNA than mammals, and some amoeba have 1,000 times more DNA? They don't tell us these things, because it doesn't fit their theory. It's impossible to arrange in any sort of evolutionary series based on just one little bit of facts. You better find all the facts. You find out this evolution theory fails miserably. But they tell the kids, we're going to think critically, boys and girls. There are 20 kinds of amino acids. That's a fact. Explain how this fact supports the idea that all life shares a common ancestor. How's a Christian kid supposed to answer that for homework for Monday? Don't you see a built-in assumption in this question? That's not learning to think critically. Would the kid be allowed, teacher, to explain how this fact that they all have 20, all life forms have 20 amino acids, would the kid be allowed to say, maybe that proves the intelligence of a common designer? Maybe God gave all the animals the same basic 20 amino acids so that we don't have to just eat each other, you know? I mean, if they're all totally different, wildly different kinds, then we could only eat other humans. But see, God made it this way so the brown cow can eat the green grass and give the white milk and make the yellow butter, and I eat it and get the blonde hair. Maybe that's why there's all the same basic building blocks. Yeah. One of the lies they face in the textbooks is this idea that all these similarities prove a common ancestor.
Thank you, Kent Hovind, and hope you did enjoy these two talks. Just to illustrate, there are big problems with the theory of evolution, and it's not anything we have to fear, not anything we have to worry about. It is a bad diversion, and the problem is too many people are taking it too seriously. And there's not much substance behind it. This is really the message we are trying to pipe out here. Okay, if you want to listen to the rest of it, you can do this at christianwarroom.com.
For the past half hour, you've been listening to the Christian War Room with host Michael Sean Bourne. For more information on how you can participate or find out more about the Christian War Room, simply go to ChristianWarRoom.com. That's ChristianWarRoom.com.